Okay, last call. Anyone need an outline for tonight? Raise your hand. We'll get you to you. Anyone need one? All right, let's turn to page 5 of your outlines and your Bibles to Psalm 22. Psalm 22. Along with Isaiah chapter 53, this is one of the more detailed prophecies about Messiah's physical sufferings, agony, that will lead to his death. But Isaiah 53, that actually spells out the reason for his death, to make atonement for sin. Here we deal with his agony and death, though the specific reason is not spelled out just yet. In your outline, I've broken this down a bit. Notice the two main segments to the psalm. First of all, Psalm 22, verses 1 through 21, focus on the sufferings of the Messiah. Then verses 22 to 31, focus on the exaltation of the Messiah. And for the sufferings that lead to death and then to exaltation, again, presupposes a resurrection will occur. Now, focus will be just on the first part of it, because that's what's relevant to Messianic Christology. Now, in the small a, we have in chapter 22, verses 1 and 2, Messiah's cry for help. My God, why have you forsaken me? It is a cry that Jesus cried upon the cross. And taken out of context, it might sound like a cry of defeat and despair. In the context of this psalm, it's a cry for help. Why are you so far from helping me? It's a cry for help, not a cry of despair, and so on. And in this prayer that he gives, in which he'll provide some details, he points out a small beam, reminding God of God's past deliverances in verses 3 through 5. And then begin to see some of the details on the small c. Messiah is despised in chapter 22, verses 6 to 8. He points out three things here. First of all, in verse 6, he'll be reproached by the people, made fun of. In verse 7, he'll be scorned. In verse 8, he'll be taunted. And in fact, as he hung on the cross, he undergoes four occasions in which he is mocked. He is mocked four different times before he gets to the cross during the arrest and trial segments. And when he's on the cross, he also suffers four more mockeries. The first group of mocking him are people who happen to be passing by. The crucifixion site was near one of the main gates of the city. It was Passover morning. The gates are open. Traffic begins. They could see who hangs on the cross. They could see the accusation and reduce it to mockery. The second group that was mocking him are the Jewish leaders. And the Gospels mention the chief priests who were Sadducees, also the elders who were Pharisees. So both Sadducees and Pharisees mock him while he's on the cross. The third group that mocks him on the cross is the Roman soldiers, rendering both Jews and Gentiles guilty of mocking him while he is on the cross. And the fourth group are the two people who were co-crucified with him. Initially, both of them participate in mocking him. After a while, one began to meditate upon the situation. He finally came to faith. But initially, both of them participate in mocking him. In my Life of Messiah research, I've tried to figure out that we can determine who the other two men crucified with him were. I have not figured out who one of them was, but I think I finally discovered who at least one of them was. One of them would have been the father of the Apostle Paul, because Romans 6, Paul says, my old man was crucified with him. A little slow on that one. Now in the small d, we have God as Messiah's total trust since he was born. There's always a continuous ongoing fellowship between the Father and the Son for the time of the Incarnation. Under small e, it gives us a more detailed description of the agony in verses 12 through 18. In verses 12 and 13, he is surrounded by people who are staring at him. And in verses 14 through 17, he focuses on the physical agony. And he mentions several things. First of all, he's poured out like water, emphasizing tremendous amount of sweat. Secondly, his bones were out of joint. Now, the way the crucifixion is portrayed in ancient historical writings is the way they stretched the hands and feet out and nailed them in. They would then pick the cross up and drop it into a hole, duck for it, and in that drop into the hole, the bones would be pulled out of joint. And that's what happened to him as the cross was raised and dropped into the hole. Thirdly, his heart is melted like wax, emphasizing a ruptured heart. Fourthly, his strength is all gone. Fifthly, his tongue cleaves to the roof of his mouth, extreme dryness of the mouth. Sixthly, his hands and feet are pierced. And one more point of agony is that his bones begin to protrude. It describes a very agonizing type death, the kind of death that would have been accomplished by means of the crucifixion. But there were no crucifixions practiced in David's day. That's an innovation that came with the Greeks and the Romans. And in verse 18, another aspect of his agony is they part my garments among them, upon my vesture do they cast lots, and they gamble for his clothing. Now, part of the ancient Roman procedure was that there would be four soldiers assigned to every crucifixion, and they would have the right of spoil that would include the clothing of the victims. And one of the other misconceptions we might get from crucifixion paintings is they show Jesus wearing a loincloth. In actuality, they were crucified naked, which in a Jewish context would simply add to the shame of it all. The average Jewish male of first century Israel wore five pieces of clothing. There was the inner garment, also called the undergarment or the tunic. There was the outer garment. Thirdly, there was the head covering of some kind. Fourthly, there were shoes or sandals. And fifthly, the outer coat or robe. And the normal procedure was that one soldier walked away with the inner garment, a second soldier the outer garment, a third soldier would take the shoes or sandals, the fourth one the head covering. And because the outer robe is the largest piece of cloth, they would simply divide into four parts. Each soldier walks away with a piece of cloth. But the kind of coat that he wore was an expensively made coat, normally worn by people of the wealthy class. And they felt it ashamed to have to rip such a coat up, and they gambled for it, cast lots for it, inadvertently fulfilling verse 18, and they parted his garments by means of casting lots. Now we know from passages in the context of the Gospels, he himself lived on the poverty level. He once told the would-be disciple, the foxes have holes and birds have nests, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So where would he get such an expensive coat? There is one indication, and that's in Luke chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, Luke 8, 1 through 3, that the ministry of Jesus was financed by several wealthy women, and it might be one of these wealthy women provided that coat. In the second portion of verses 19 to 21, this section concludes with Messiah's prayer for help, which is a prayer that was openly answered. Not that he was saved from dying on the cross, but he was saved out of death by means of resurrection. As in the second part of the psalm, verses 22 to 31, he talks about the day that Israel will finally recognize him and come back to him at a future point of time. But here you don't have the burial mentioned, but the death and resurrection are clearly mentioned. So let's bring out the main points this passage makes about messianic Christology. First of all, in extreme agony, the Messiah will call out for God's help. In extreme agony, the Messiah will call out for God's help. Secondly, the Messiah will be a despised and rejected individual. despised and rejected. Thirdly, in the agony of death, the Messiah will be stared at. Fourthly, Messiah's bones will be pulled out of joint. Fifthly, the Messiah's heart will rupture. This was evident because when the side was pierced, out came blood and water, the sign of a ruptured heart. Sixthly, Messiah will suffer the agony of extreme thirst. And one of the seven statements from the cross will be, I thirst. Seven, the Messiah's hands and feet will be pierced. Eight, Messiah's clothing will be divided by the casting of lots. Nine, the point of Messiah's death, the Messiah's whole trust will be in God. And 10th, he will be resurrected. Now we'll go to Psalm 80. Now Psalm 80 is again something yet prophetic when Israel finally recognizes their shepherd and calls upon him to come and to rescue them from a specific predicament. What's relevant to our study of Messianic Christology is the statement he makes in verse 17. Psalm 80, verse 17. Addressing their prayer to God, they say, let your hand be upon the man of your right hand, upon thee, Son of Man, whom you made strong for yourself. And note the one they're asking for specifically is the one, the right hand of God. And they refer to him as the Son of Man. And that will be Jesus the Messiah, who's been sitting at the right hand of God ever since his ascension, resulting from Israel's rejection. That the one that is now seated at the right hand of God, they ask for this one to now return to rescue them. Now look at Psalm 110. Now, we've already noted from the law that the Messiah was to be a prophet, and we also noted several times in the prophets that he'll also be a king. It is in this passage we find out about a third office Messiah is to have. And the first stanza in verse 1, Jehovah said unto my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool, and Jehovah will send forth the rod of your strength out of Zion, rule in the midst of your enemies. Now notice that this is a psalm of David. And David says, Jehovah said unto my Lord. Who is David's Lord? Who is distinct from God? And keep in mind, within the human sphere, he was the highest position. He was not merely the king of a kingdom. He was also the emperor of an empire, since he had spread the borders of Israel and surrounded, ruled all the surrounding countries as well. As from a human perspective, David had no higher authority than himself. And yet David has the Lord, and the Lord is not the same as Jehovah. And you see one of those passages where you have a plurality within the Godhead. And now Jehovah says to David's Lord, sit at my right hand. And here you have a prophecy which is the result of the ascension. As he ascends into heaven, he will sit upon the right hand of God the Father. Now, from the context and custom and tradition of biblical times, to sit at one's right hand is to be one's equal. To sit at one's right hand is to be one's equal. One example of this is in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 19. 1 Kings 2:19. As so one, when one king made a visit of state to another king, he would sit on the host's king's right hand to show equality. And the fact that David's Lord is sitting at the right hand of Jehovah shows him to be equal with Jehovah, to be equal with God. And there he sits until his enemies are made his footstool. And that presupposes Messiah's first coming. It presupposes he came and faced hostility. The enemies in the context of the people of Zion, as you have a prophecy of his ascension and present session at the right hand of God the Father. In the second stanza, verse 3 and 4, we read, your people offered themselves willingly in the day of your power in holy array. Out of the womb of the morning you have the dew of your youth. Jehovah has sworn and will not repent. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Elijah prophesies a future time when Israel will change its mind about this one and accept him as the Messiah, and they come to him willingly. But he points out he also make this one a priest, but not a priest after the order of Aaron. He would not qualify for the Aaronic order since he was not of the tribe of Levi. He'll be a priest after the order of Melchizedek, and this is established by God's oath. And notice he both serves as a priest and also rules as a king in this context. And that would never be permissible under the Mosaic law. The priest had to come from Levi, the king had to come from Judah, and therefore no man could ever be both king and priest at the same time. But under the kingdom law, we will no longer be operating under the Aaronic priesthood, but under the Melchizedekian priesthood. And just as Melchizedek was both king and priest of Jerusalem, so will this one be both king and priest of Jerusalem. And the third stanza in verses 5 to 7 describes the all-conquering king, where he will come and destroy the wicked and have a final triumph with his messianic kingdom. Let's draw our deductions from what this passage teaches. First of all, the Messiah will be a priest king after the order of Melchizedek. Secondly, the Messiah will have to be the God-man. Thirdly, at his first coming, the Messiah will be rejected. And so fourthly, he will ascend into heaven. And fifthly, in heaven he will seat at the right hand of God the Father. Sixthly, the Messiah will return only when Israel accepts him. And again, the distinction between the rapture and the second coming among several is the rapture has no preconditions. It may happen any moment of time, but the second coming does have this key precondition, Israel's national salvation. And then suddenly, he'll rule over Israel in the Messianic kingdom. Now, dealing with his three offices of prophet, priest, and king, while he holds three offices, he does not function in all three offices simultaneously, but in chronological sequence. And so during his first coming, he functioned in the office of a prophet. A prophet is one who receives direct revelation from God and will do two things with it. First of all, he will proclaim God's will for his own generation. And secondly, he will predict future events both near and far. And during his first coming, he was a prophet receiving direct revelation from God the Father. He proclaimed the will of God for his own generation, as in the Sermon of the Mount in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. But secondly, also predicted future events both near and far in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and 25. With his ascension, he ceased to function as a prophet and now functions as a priest. And to this day, he is our high priest in heaven, ever making intercession for us. And John refers to him as the advocate because part of the priestly role involved dealing with issue of trials, so he's also our lawyer, making the session for us. In case you're not aware of this, if you're a believer, you do have a Jewish lawyer sitting at the right hand of God the Father. He's never lost a case yet. That's where his salvation is eternally secure. So he was a prophet, as a priest. He has not yet functioned as king, the king of Israel, the king of the world, that awaits his second coming. But he functions in these three offices in chronological sequence. All right, let's go to Proverbs chapter 30. Proverbs chapter 30. Now, chapter 30, verse 4, the author asks six questions. The first four questions, the answers are obvious. First question, who had ascended up into heaven and descended? Second question, who has gathered the wind in his fists? Third question, who has bound the waters in his garments? Fourth question, who has established all the ends of the earth? And these four questions are all relevant to the work of creation. And the answer to all of these four questions is obviously God from Genesis 1 and 2. Then comes the fifth question, what is his name? And his name is Yahweh, Jehovah Adonai, YHVH, that's his personal name. Then comes the sixth and trick question, what is his son's name, if you know? At that point, they didn't know what the son's name would be. But this passage, along with Psalm 2, is the two passages that show that God has a son, a messianic son, and the key point of this verse is Messiah is uniquely the Son of God. Then go on to page 6 and turn to Daniel chapter 9. Daniel chapter 9, this is the last of the messianic Christology passages. And this is the minimum I wanted to get through, my goal, which we'll fulfill, and then we'll see what else we'll cover and what's left in the outline. The historical background is provided for us in chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years whereof the word of Jehovah came to Jeremiah the prophet for the accomplishing of the desolations of Jerusalem, even 70 years. Now the date he provides for us, the first year of Darius, was the year 539 BC. So it's been about 66 or 67 years since the captivity, which began in the year 605 BC, and Daniel was taken in the year 605 BC. Darius mentioned here is of the seed of the Medes, who was made the king over the realm of the Chaldeans. He was made king by Cyrus. Cyrus was the emperor of the Medo-Persian Empire. And Darius was of the Medes, while Cyrus was of the Persians, and he made Darius king over the province of Babylon. Babylon now became just one province of the Medo-Persian Empire. And we'll note in verse 2 that Daniel was studying the scriptures, and he understood by the books, notice the word is plural, by the books the number of years for the accomplishing of desolations of Jerusalem, even 70 years. So he looked at more than one book, but one book that he mentions by name is the book of Jeremiah. And keep in mind, the last years of Jeremiah correspond with the first years of Daniel, and Daniel already recognized that the book Jeremiah left behind was the word of God. And twice Jeremiah predicted a 70-year captivity. First of all, in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 10 through 14, chapter 25, verses 10 through 14, and a second time in chapter 29, verses 10 through 14, chapter 29, 10 through 14. A second book he might have easily used is the book of Isaiah, because Isaiah twice names Cyrus as being the one allowed the Jews to come back from Babylonian captivity. Twice Isaiah names him, Isaiah chapter 44, verse 28, Isaiah 44, 28, and chapter 45, verse 1, 45, 1. And other books, like Leviticus 26, for example, the other prophets all spelled out the one precondition that must be fulfilled before the kingdom could be established. And again, the one precondition is Israel's national salvation. And therefore, Israel must confess their sin and look to God by faith, which is what Daniel will do on behalf of the people. And not, he mentions in verse 2 the word of Jehovah. The only time God's name is used in the book of Daniel is in this chapter, chapter 9. This is a name of God that focuses on God as a covenant keeper. And because Daniel recognizes that the return from captivity is a matter of covenant faithfulness, he therefore uses God's name. He'll use it 7 times in this one chapter. It's not used at all in his book, except in this one chapter. Because God is a promise-keeping God, he will definitely fulfill the 70 years of captivity. And 70 years of captivity should run from 605 till 536. 605 till 536. And Daniel recognizes it has only about 3 years to go. He then mentions the accomplishing of the desolations of Jerusalem. Now, Daniel correctly understood that the Babylonian captivity would last exactly 70 years, and therefore it was soon to terminate. That's what he understood correctly. What he did not understand correctly is that he made the assumption that with the end of 70 years, the Messianic kingdom is going to be established. That's what he understood, but understood incorrectly. And therefore, in this chapter, he acts as if the kingdom is about to be established. He knows the word of God is fulfilled on the basis of prayer, so he prays. He knows there needs to be a confession of national sin, and therefore he confesses not his own sin, but the sins of the nation. He was not guilty of the sins he confesses, but he identifies himself with the people of Israel. Center point 2 of Daniel's prayer and confession in chapter 9, verses 3 through 19. In verses 3 through 14, he confesses the sins of Israel. And then in verses 15 through 19, he pleads for God's mercy. And so we come down to point 3 on your outline, Gabriel's mission in verses 20 through 23. And verse 20 describes Gabriel's arrival. And while I was speaking, while Daniel was praying, while he was confessing his sin, the sins of his people Israel, while he was presenting a supplication, suddenly he gets his prayer life is interrupted. An interruption is done by Gabriel in verse 21. Yet while I was speaking in prayer, before he finished praying, the man Gabriel. Gabriel's an angel, but when angels appear visibly, they always appear as young men, often mistaken for young men. And so often when people saw an angel, they took him to be young men, since that is how they appear. And he mentions whom I had seen the vision at the beginning. He saw Gabriel once before, back in chapter 8, verses 16 to 27. Chapter 8, verses 16 to 27. And Gabriel mentions that he was flying swiftly. He says, he touched me about the time of the evening sacrifice. Now keep in mind, the sacrifice on evenings had not been practiced now for almost 7 decades. For 7 decades, there's been no sacrifice. And yet, Daniel is conscious of its timing. And the arrival of Gabriel is about the time that was normally the time of the evening sacrifice. And the purpose of Gabriel's coming in verse 22 is he came for the purpose of instructing Daniel to correct his misunderstanding about the timing of the setting up of the kingdom. Yes, the captivity will end in 70 years, but that's not the timing of the establishment of the kingdom. And I will reveal to Daniel the program or bring in the Messianic kingdom. So Gabriel says, I am not come forth to give you wisdom and to give you understanding. And in verse 23, he points out this is an answer to Daniel's prayer. And Gabriel tells Daniel that from the time he actually began the prayer of chapter 9, that's when Gabriel was sent out. And he arrived to Daniel before Daniel's prayer was finished. So how fast do angels travel? Here's a bit of irrelevancy you can impress your friends with. If you read this prayer in Hebrew at the normal pace, it takes about 3 minutes to read Daniel's prayer. 3 minutes to read his prayer. So how long does it take for an angel to travel from heaven to earth? About 3 minutes. Impress that in a conversation sometime with the friends you're with. The message is therefore, understand the matter and understand the vision. And that brings us to point 4, the 77s in verses 24 through 27. What we have here is the only prophecy of the first coming that provides a timetable for the first coming. Now, broken down this segment further in your outline, small a, the revelation of the 77s in verse 24a. 77s are decreed upon your people and upon your holy city. Now, most translations read 70 weeks. There is a Hebrew word that means 70 weeks, but it's not the word Daniel uses. He uses a different Hebrew word that means sevens. So it's not 70 weeks, but 77, so 490 of something. What that something is determined by the context. It's like our word dozen. When I say dozen, you know what I mean by dozen, 12, but 12 of what? That depends on the context. It might be 12 eggs, it might be 12 rolls, it might be 12 of something else. In this context, keep in mind he's been thinking in terms of years, the 70 years of captivity. And so the 77s are 77s of years. He's saying God has decreed a period of 490 years upon the people of Israel. So it's a play upon words. No, Daniel, not 70 years for the kingdom, but 77s of years for the kingdom. So again, he says that a 490-year period has now been decreed. The Hebrew word for decree means to cut out, to determine, to cut out, to determine. And Daniel's main theme throughout his book has been on the times of the Gentiles, describing the four Gentile empires from Babylon until the fourth empire culminates with the last ruler, and finally the last ruler destroyed by the second coming. But of this long period of time of the times of the Gentiles, he cuts out a 490-year period that is going to be affecting the Jewish people and the people of Israel. And so a 490-year period has been determined or decreed for the accomplishment of Israel's final restoration. And he'll go on to divide these 490 years of the 77s into three units. There'll be seven sevens, or 49 years. Seven sevens, 49 years, then 62 sevens, which is 434 years, 62 sevens, 434 years, and finally 1 7, which is a period of 7 years. And note the focus of the 77s upon your people, Daniel's people, the Jewish people, upon your holy city, Daniel's holy city, Jerusalem. In other words, the program of the 77s does not apply to the church. It doesn't apply to the Gentiles, it applies specifically to the Jewish people. It will involve both the first and second coming of the Messiah. But the 77s is not relevant to the church at all. Now, small b, the purpose of the 77s, the second part of verse 24. And he points out the 77s are for the accomplishment of 6 things. The first 3 are things which are negative, things which are going to be removed. And the second 3 are things which are positive, desirable elements, elements that will be effected, brought in by the 77s. And the positives are response to the negatives. And so the first negative is responded to by the first positive. So for example, 1 and 4 go together, 2 and 5 go together, number 3 and number 6 go together. The first purpose is to finish the transgression. The word to finish means to restrain firmly, to restrain completely, to bring to completion. And the word transgression is a singular in the Hebrew text. Emphasize, it's a very strong word for sin. It means to rebel. It's a very specific rebellion. It's got a definite article in the Hebrew text. It is to finish the transgression, a specific one. To finish the transgression, a specific one. The specific one is what we saw in Isaiah chapter 53, verses 1 through 9. Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9, also Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10, 12:10, Israel's rebellion by the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus and even accusing him of being demon-possessed. And so the aim is now to finish this act of rebellion and to bring Israel to recognize that he was not a demonized false Messiah, but the true one, and to finish this, the transgression. Second purpose, to make an end of sins, plural. And sinning will cease in Israel in that day. This is a word that refers to sins in the daily life. And they will cease to sin. Thirdly, to make reconciliation for iniquity. Reconciliation is the Hebrew word for the atonement. To make atonement, and because he makes atonement for Israel, that's why the national sin is removed, that's why daily sins are removed, and that's why there is reconciliation, or better, atonement for iniquity. Iniquity refers to the sin nature. Those are the three categories so far. Number one, Israel's rebellion against the Messiah by calling him demonized. Secondly, daily sins. And now thirdly, for the sin nature, internal sin. These are three elements that will be removed. Now fourthly, to bring in everlasting righteousness, or more correct, the age of righteousness, which will be the Messianic kingdom. Fifthly, to seal up vision and prophecy, emphasizing the fulfillment of all prophecies. So what has not been fulfilled by the program of the first coming will be fulfilled by the program of the second coming. The word vision refers to oral prophecy. The word prophecy refers to written prophecy. He will cause a cessation of both oral and written prophecies because all of these prophecies will be fulfilled. And the function will finally come to a cessation with the second coming. And the kingdom will become the high point. The kingdom was the high point of Old Testament prophecy. In fact, no prophet ever saw beyond the Messianic kingdom into the eternal order. That comes with New Testament revelation. And now the high point of Old Testament prophecy will find its full fulfillment. And sixthly, to anoint the most holy, more correct in Hebrew, a most holy place, referring to the millennial temple that was detailed by Daniel's contemporary, Ezekiel, in chapters 40 through 48 of his book. So the 77s have the purpose of fulfilling these six items. And now small c, the start of the 77s. He says, know therefore and discern that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem. As you know, the cream to rebuild Jerusalem. Now there are four basic decrees which people have basically suggested as to the starting point. Of these four, two are primary. The first one would be the decree of Cyrus, which was issued in the year 538 or 537, the decree of Cyrus of 538 or 537. And the fourth decree is the decree of Artaxerxes to Nehemiah, the decree of Artaxerxes to Nehemiah. I don't have either time at this point, and in a context like this, I can't go through all the details. But you may take one view or the other. If you take the Cyrus view, you end up with the birth of the Messiah. If you take the Artaxerxes view, you end up with the triumphal entry. Now, the one person who has gone into determining to the very day concerning the fulfillment of this passage is a man named Sir Robert Anderson, who wrote a book called The Coming Prince, The Coming Prince. And he made the various calculations, adding the various leap years and things of that nature. And his conclusion was that from Nehemiah until the triumphal entry was the exact period of time. And he ended up with a 32 AD crucifixion. But as others have noticed, that could not be correct because Anderson pointed out both a Friday crucifixion but also a 32 AD. But if you have a Friday crucifixion, it has to be the 30 or 33. It cannot be 32. And so Harold Horner from Dallas Seminary recalculated Anderson's figures and pointed out the couple errors he made. He used the same system, but he was more accurate, and concluded with an AD 33 crucifixion, but he also begins with the decree of Artaxerxes, concluding with a triumphal entry. So if you go with the fourth decree, then it's fulfilled with the triumphal entry. If you go with the first decree, it comes with the birth of the Messiah. And no matter which decree you go with, one thing is obvious. The arrival of the Messiah has to be before AD 70. The arrival of the Messiah has to be before AD 70. At that point, the temple is destroyed, something I'll mention here momentarily. Now, in the second part of verse 25, with small d now, he deals with the first 69 sevenths. And he first of all deals with the seven sevenths. This is the first subdivision of the seven sevenths, a total of 49 years. And that refers to the period of time it took to rebuild Jerusalem. It'll be built over a 49-year period, even in troublous times. And so the first subdivision, seven sevenths, 49 years, is the period of time they took for them to rebuild the temple. The second subdivision follows the first subdivision. There is no implication of a break between the first and second subdivision, notice. And so the 62 sevenths, or the 434 years, immediately follows the seven sevenths, or the 49 years, giving us a total of 69 sevenths, or 483 years. And so the Messiah must be here on earth 483 years after the decree is issued, whether it be Cyrus or Artaxerxes. He simply says, unto Messiah the Prince. It doesn't specify necessarily a triumphal entry. It could refer to his birth, but it could, if you go with the second, with the fourth decree, you go to a triumphal entry. But what we can summarize so far is this. From the decree of Cyrus, or Artaxerxes, until the appearance of the Messiah will be 483 years. 483 years. And that requires the first coming to be here sometime before AD 70. Now again, there was no implication of a gap of time between the first and second subdivision. But now he points out there will be a gap of time between the second and third subdivision. Look at small e, the interval between the 69th seventh and the 70th seventh. And after 62 sevenths, after the second subdivision, and that phrase already tells you there's a gap of time between the second and third subdivision. In this gap of time, three things will happen. Number one, the Messiah shall be cut off and shall have nothing. As it was used in Isaiah, notice the Messiah is cut off. He is killed. He is killed in illegal execution. And shall have nothing. The Hebrew word might mean nothingness, meaning there's no messianic kingdom when he dies. Or it may mean, but not for himself, means he died for others. He didn't die for himself. The Hebrew allows either one, but both statements end up being true anyway. The second that will occur is that the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood. Not the phrase, the people of the prince that shall come. It's not the prince that shall come that shall destroy the city and the temple, notice, but the people of the prince that shall come that will destroy the city and the temple. The prince that shall come is the one Daniel spoke of twice before in chapter 7 and chapter 8, the one we now call the Antichrist. He's definitely article here in verse 26 because he spoke of him twice before in his book. But it's not the Antichrist that will destroy the city and the temple, but the people out of whom the Antichrist will arise will destroy the city and the temple. It's not a matter of history who's responsible for destroying the city and the temple, and that was the Romans. And the point of this verse is that whoever the Antichrist is, as to his ethnic identity, he'll be a Gentile of Roman origin. He'll be a Gentile of Roman origin. But the people on which he will arise will destroy the city and the temple. The Messiah died in the year 30 or 33, and therefore, and then the temple was destroyed 40 years later in the year AD 70. So again, the second event in this gap of time is the city's destruction. It happens about 40 years after Messiah is killed. It says, the end of the earth shall be with a flood. When the figure of a flood is used symbolically, it's always a symbol of a military invasion. And Jerusalem was destroyed by the military invasion of Rome, first under Vespasian and then by Titus. The third thing that happens in this gap of time is, even to the end shall be war. For the remainder of the interval, the land will be characterized by war, as it is to this day. And that will set the stage for the last 7 years. Now, because there was no gap of time between the first and second subdivision, we did not need to know what triggers the second subdivision. Because there is a gap of time between the second and third subdivision, we need to know what will trigger the third subdivision. And that brings us to verse 27. And he shall make a firm covenant with many for 1:7. Now the pronoun he in verse 27 goes back to its nearest antecedent in verse 26, which is the prince that shall come. In other words, the prince that shall come in verse 26 and the he who makes a covenant in verse 27 is the one, the same individual. Better known now circles, today is simply the Antichrist. And the last 7 years begin with a treaty signed between Israel and the Antichrist. It's not the rapture of the church that will trigger the tribulation. The rapture will simply come sometime before the tribulation starts. When before, we don't know. What triggers the tribulation is the signing of the seven-year covenant, which presupposes two things must be in place. First of all, there must be a Jewish state or a Jewish government would whom a covenant like this could be signed, and that has been true as of 1948. The second thing is not yet in place. The Antichrist must be in high political authority that with whom a covenant could be signed, and that is yet to come. But this third subdivision is also divided into two smaller units, he points out in verse 27. It says, in the middle of the seven, he will cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And the 7 years are divided into two parts, sometimes referred to as 1,260 days, sometimes referred to as 42 months, and sometimes as a phrase, time times and a half a time, it only equal 3.5 years, then there'll be 2 3.5-year periods. But the midpoint of the first 3.5 years, he will break the covenant with Israel, take over the Jewish temple, seat himself in it, and proclaim himself to being God, and call upon the whole world to worship him as God. And that will be the commitment of what Daniel calls the abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation. I'm already getting questions, is Obama the Antichrist? I tell people, I don't think he can be the Antichrist. Maybe he'll fulfill the prophecy about the abomination of desolation, but not likely. And there'll be a continuous period of desolation upon the Jewish people, until the period terminates with Israel's national salvation and the second coming. So in this prophecy, we have a unique prophecy giving us a clear timetable of the second coming. Let's summarize what this of the first and second coming, but the first coming is the dated item, the second coming is not. Let me go ahead and make some points about this passage about Messianic Christology. Number one, Messiah will appear 483 years after the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, whether it's the Cyrus decree or the Artaxerxes decree. Secondly, the Messiah will be killed validly in a legal execution. Thirdly, the Messiah's rejection will result in the destruction of the city and the temple. So fourthly, Messiah's death has to come before AD 70. Now within this book, two things are especially relevant to what happens later in Matthew chapter 2. Number one, early in the book, Daniel becomes the head of the Babylonian school of astrology, not because he ever practiced astrology, as a loyal Jew to the Mosaic law, he would not engage in that kind of practice. But he's made the head of the school because of Nebuchadnezzar's lack of insight. And notice that Daniel had these unique abilities to interpret dreams and solve riddles. He made the faulty assumption that he was a superior astrologer, made him the head of the Babylonian school. But Daniel never received any revelation from the stars, only from the creator of the stars, the God of Israel. And secondly, one day it saved the lives of all the other wise men of Babylon. When they could not interpret a dream Nebuchadnezzar had, he sentenced all of them to be executed. Among the ones arrested for execution did include Daniel. From the Babylonian perspective, he was part of that association. But Daniel asked to receive an audience with the king. He interpreted the king's dream, and by so doing, saved the lives of all the other wise men. And no doubt, as a result, many turned away from worshiping the stars and began to worship the creator of the stars, the God of Daniel, the God of Israel. And they had in their possession this book, the book of Daniel, written by the former president, to give a timetable for the first coming. And connecting this with the Balaam's prophecy, the star will arise out of Jacob, and Balaam was also from Babylonia. When they saw this new light up in the heavens, and because the timing was right based upon Daniel's prophecy, and by virtue of Balaam's prophecy, it turned out to be the sign that the Messiah was finally born. As a result, they came to Jerusalem with the question, where is he that was born king of the Jews, and why Jerusalem? Because as Matthew 2 shows that while they had the book of Daniel, they didn't have the book of Micah. And Micah 5:2 prophesied there'll be Bethlehem, that'll be the place of Messiah's birth, not Jerusalem. And that's what brought him finally to Bethlehem, and they found the Messianic person. So these are the various prophecies we have of the first coming. And notice how complete the picture we get once we have the totality of the Old Testament together. And in dealing with Jewish evangelism, use these passages to portray what kind of Messiah did the Old Testament anticipate. And then once that is made clear, then we can move on to the New Testament, that Jesus actually fulfilled these prophecies. And many Jewish people have come to faith as a result of this procedure. Well, I'm not going to have time to do anything else on the outline. In the book Messianic Christology, all of these areas are covered in a bit more detail than I've covered here, and all of these other sections of 6 and 7 are also taken care of. You have enough evidence to deal with the Trinity and things of that nature. Just to show you my favorite passage on the Trinity in the Old Testament, let's look at one more passage, Isaiah 48. Isaiah chapter 48. The starting point is to go back to verse 12 to notice who the speaker is. Hearken unto me, O Jacob, and Israel my called. I am he. I am the first, also the last. Yea, my hand had laid the foundation of the earth, and my right hand has spread out the heavens. When I call them, they stand up together. And so on. Notice the speaker is the one responsible for creation, the eternal one, the first and last, beginning and end. So God is obviously the speaker. The speaker continues now in verse 16. Verse 16, come ye near unto me, hear ye this. From the beginning I have not spoken in secret. From the time that I was, there am I. And now the Lord Jehovah has sent me and his Spirit. Those three persons. The speaker, who is the creator. The Lord Jehovah, who begot the Father. And the Spirit is the Holy Spirit, and therefore the speaker, who begot the Son. These are not the only examples of a triune concept in the Old Testament, but it's probably one of the best ones in the Old Testament, and clearly three persons. Okay, a couple announcements before we have our last offering and have our closing song. If anybody here has felt led to make a monetary commitment to our ministries, be sure to fill in this page of the leaflet out. Let us know what the amount is. Give us your name and address. Tear the slip off. Either drop in the offering or leave it on the literature table. If you make any kind of any commitment, simply wait till you hear from us. We will let you know by letter when to begin sending your commitment in. And now, the only time you'll hear from us about this, we do not send out reminders and things of that nature. We really believe this between you and the Lord. If God does supply the amount, you'll commit yourself to it. You'll send it in, but if God doesn't, you won't send it in. It's really that simple. And that's how this ministry is financed. Also, if you'd like to receive our mailings, you can fill out the slip, whether you're able to make a commitment or not, doesn't matter. We're happy to send you a Bible studies through the mail. So you fill this out, we'll send you some more information. For example, we'll send you a copy of our catalog, a copy of our correspondence course you can take either for credit or on your own, or you can and a copy of my personal testimony. After that, every 3 months, we'll send you newsletters like this. It is 12 pages at the moment, soon to become 16 pages, and it contains news of the branches, report Jewish people coming to faith, and then articles on Jewish customs and traditions. But also inside will be always a 4-page Bible study. Each issue picks a different topic. This one is the sequence of pre-trib events. And we make this available to all who want it free of charge. If you want to receive it, simply fill this form out and turn it in. We're also happy to send it to you by email. If you prefer it that way, just give us your email address on the form and that'll be fine as well. Also, if you're able to join us in our Camp Shoshana program, if you like these Jewish-style studies, it's going to be a 6-week program running from the beginning of July until mid-August. And if you don't have 6 weeks, you're welcome to come for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever time you have. And all of the various courses being taught at different times of the weeks, this will give you the information. And if you're free to come, you're more than welcome to attend the program. And you'll find these on the literature table. And again, if you're interested in attending our Israel study tour, leaving May 31 for a 4-week trip, 3.5 weeks in Israel, and then 4 days in Jordan. Help yourself to the information sheets in the back table, and I'll give you the details. Also, if you intend to sign up for any of the books or tapes or manuscripts or MP3s or DVDs, make sure you fill out these envelopes out tonight and turn them in to the lady that'll be taking care of the table. And if you... I'll be sending all of these order forms to the office tomorrow, and they'll be able to fill it in fairly quickly, so you can follow up that way. And now for the offering, if you'd like to receive a receipt for the amount you gave this week or give tonight, mark the amount in the upper left-hand corner where it says I'm enclosing so much in today's offering. We'll be happy to send you a numbered receipt for your tax records. And if you wish to make a check out, just make the check out to all our ministries, and that'll be sufficient. Hallelujah.
And on Christmas time, they showed a very, very fair thing called, what was the Christmas star?
Oh, yeah.
Surprising.
I'm glad they believe in it. Okay, last opportunity for this conference. If you have a question, raise your hand. We'll go from there. Who's got the first question?
I have heard that the Antichrist would be a black man. Does
Israel
support that?
The only reason people say that now is because, probably because of Obama. But he'll be a Gentile Roman origin, so he'll be a Howley. But he won't be black. Fun? In the passage we looked at in Daniel, he has to be of the same ethnic identity as the people who destroyed the city in the temple. And that was the Romans. Just to be a Gentile of Roman origin. Question? Psalm 22 looked upon as messianic only by some rabbis. It was not a uniform view. Like Isaiah 53 was very uniform. All rabbis took it to be messianic. That's not true with Psalm 22. But even those that didn't take it to be messianic had a hard time determining if this refers to David. When did this happen? When did he suffer these things? There's no record of him suffering this way, in this manner, anywhere in the books that we have about David. So It was a view, but not across the board. You have a second question?
Yes. What's the rationale for placing Daniel in the writings instead of the
prophets? He's put in the writings because he was not by profession a prophet. He was a statesman. So because he was a statesman, doesn't mean they recognize he gave prophecies. They do. Because they recognize David gave prophecies, but they don't put him in the category of the prophets. So because he was not a professional prophet, they didn't put him in that sphere. I view him as a prophet. This is what they do with the Hebrew division, so that's why we did it that way. Question? Yeah. comes from misunderstanding what that passage says. It's already been 60 years, so it passed a generation. Why don't you turn to Matthew 24. Let's look what the context actually is. It begins with verse 32, Matthew 24, verse 32. Now from the fig tree learn her parable. When the branches now become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is nigh. Even so, you also, when you see all these things, know that it is nigh even at the doors. Well, I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished. And the way people have interpreted verse 32 is that the fig tree here represents Israel. And the generation they took to be 40 years, and therefore, when Israel became a state in 48, the rapture, second coming, must come by 1988. Well, 88 came and went, and nothing happened. So they recalculated and says, no, it shouldn't be taken from 48, it should be from 67 when they captured Jerusalem, and therefore the rapture, second coming, will come around 2008, and this is now 2009. But they made a faulty assumption. They made two faulty assumptions. First of all, the fig tree here is used as a symbol for Israel. It's not being used as a symbol for Israel here. It's used literally as an illustration. Now keep your finger here and turn just for a moment to Luke's parallel account, Luke 21. Look at verse 29. 21:29, he spoke to them a parable. Behold a fig tree. Notice what else Luke says. And all the trees. Well, the fig tree is Israel, what these other trees represent. And if the other trees represent other nations, when do you begin your calculations? Because different nations rise up at different points of time. So again, he's not using the fig tree or these other trees as a symbol of Israel or other nations. He's using it literally as an illustration. When the fig tree and these other trees blossom, it's a sign summer's coming. Application, when you see these things, Noah's coming is not even the doors. I'll come back to that in a moment. Go back to Matthew. The second miscalculation is that the term generation must always mean 40 years. And sometimes it does mean that, but it's not always that way. Sometimes it means 60 years, sometimes 80 years. And there's one passage that means 100 years, and that's in Genesis chapter 15, where God says to Abraham, know for certain that your seed shall be sojourners, land that is not theirs. They shall afflict them 400 years. In the fourth generation, they shall come out again with great substance. Four centuries, four generations. How long is a generation there? A century. But most of the time, the word generation is used the way we use it in English, contemporaries. When I talk about my generation, as if it gets my father's generation, that does not apply to this 40 years between us. Between us, there was 22 years. I mean his contemporaries or against my contemporaries. That's the way it's used here. So going back to Matthew 24, when you see these things, verse 33, notice, then you know it's not even the doors. What does these things refer to? It's not the reestablishment of Israel. That's nowhere in the context. The context begins verse 15. When you see the abomination of desolation, the one spoken of by Daniel the prophet, and that from Daniel's prophecy they would know that from the abomination until the second coming is exactly 1,260 days. From the abomination to the second coming, 1,260 days. And this event occurs at the midpoint of the tribulation. The point is this, the same Jewish generation that sees the abomination is still here when Christ comes back 3.5 years later. It's a word of comfort because the abomination signals Satan's last attempt to annihilate the Jews once and for all. The abomination begins a Nazi-like persecution of the Jews. The Jews survive until the end of the tribulation when Christ comes back. So it's not to have anything to do with Israel's reestablishment, the recapture of Jerusalem. This event begins only at the midpoint of the tribulation, and then you can start counting. But we won't be here to count. Question? Yes. I was never restored, and I was only restored after he passed away. He passed away on New Year's Day in 91. And then my mother was never opposed to me, per se. She did not like what I believed in and so on, but she was not the one, she was not kicking me out of the home. That was my father's doing. So once he passed away, I was free to come home at will. Question? Any other questions? Any last questions? You must be hungry.